Hello, my name is Sam Clement, and welcome to the Love of Cinema Picture House podcast. And welcome to the December edition of our show. Crikey, it's December. We've been doing this show now. We relaunched in June 2021, so this is our six-month anniversary. Thank you to everybody who joined us when we relaunched the show when cinemas reopened back in the UK earlier this year. And also, you know, welcome if this is your first time. Welcome to the Love of Cinema. It's a safe space. We're all film fans here. And yeah, it's great to have you on board. In this December edition of the show, we're going to cover some of the big releases coming to your local picture house in the next month. And I won't be doing that alone. I will be joined by two critics whose work I think is incredible. They're two of my favourite critics working today, and not just film critics, film writers, film broadcasters, film podcasters. So we are joined by Anna Bogatskaya and Christina Newland. And I've included some links to their work and their social media handles in the show notes. Should you want to read or listen to more, I highly, highly recommend you do. And so grateful they were able to join us to watch the films this month. My role on the podcast is to merely guide us through the show and then to deliver a little bit of admin. And actually, the first bit of admin I'd love to ask is if you don't already subscribe or follow the show on your podcatcher app of choice, please do. That makes a huge difference to the algorithms who like to point people to various podcasts. So do click subscribe if you can and help others find the show. And if your podcast app allows star ratings or reviews, please do leave us a five-star rating and drop a few words in. You know, it's really nice to hear your feedback, and it's great for prospective listeners to see what their peers think of a podcast. Again, it helps others find the show. We put a lot of work into the show, so it's great to get it out to as wide an audience as possible. And let's talk about some films that are coming to your local picture house. I should say, we're going to talk about four films on this month's podcast. And as ever, there are more than four films that are opening in cinemas in the UK this month in December. But of course, you know, the podcast would be about 17 hours long if we were to cover all of them. So we picked four of the ones that we at Picture House are most excited for. And yes, there are things like Spider-Man No Way Home and Matrix Resurrections coming too. But we thought, you know, everyone's aware of those, right? We wanted to go for some films that maybe don't have quite as big a marketing campaign behind them. So on the show this month, we will be covering West Side Story, Lamb, Hope. We have a special interview with the director of Hope, in fact, and we'll be covering the Palme d'Or winner, a film called Titane. So that's the running order, and I think that's probably enough from me. I'm going to swiftly hand over to our guest film critics, Christina Newland and Anna Bogatskaya, to talk about West Side Story, the new film from Steven Spielberg.
I'm a grown-up now, Bernardo. I'm gonna think for myself.
Tony, we need you if we're going to war.
Christina, we both went to see Steven Spielberg's take on West Side Story yesterday. This is probably one of the biggest films to be coming out this year, definitely one of the biggest musicals. What did you make of it? Were you excited to see it?
I was excited to see it, actually. I initially have the feeling about old Hollywood classics that, you know, they're burnished things and should we really be remaking them? But I saw this trailer and, you know, it is Spielberg and he is masterful at blocking and masterful at putting a shot together. And so I thought, you know, I have high hopes for this. It was beautiful and beautifully choreographed, and the execution of some of the songs, like some of my favorite songs from the original of America, Officer Krupke, really great, really inventive.
Yeah, it felt like a homage to me, which worked really well because you could tell through the control of the craft, really, that Spielberg has been kind of ready to make this film. And I know that he loves the original adaptation of the musical, and that love really seeps into every single frame of it. And I gotta say, some of the supporting cast really were the ones that drew me in emotionally. But other than that, the central story, and I kind of felt the same about the original, but this one, the love story between Marie and Tony really did not work for me. It didn't tell me anything. I couldn't feel their emotion. It felt very schmaltzy, and also I just don't think Ansel Elgort is a good leading man. So anytime he was on screen, the film fell flat for me. But anytime the Riff or Bernardo or Anita were on screen, it really came alive for me. So those were the ones that really, the supporting cast, I think, really elevated this into something with feeling. But the central love story felt quite flat.
It's interesting about that too, because I think the original West Side Story has a lot of the same problems, like some of the inherent weaknesses of the original film. Much as I love it, it's the same sort of thing where there are flashes of incredible brilliance and visually it's stunning, beautiful low angle shots. But Bernardo and Anita's characters in the original are also stronger and more interesting than this very, like you say, schmaltzy love story between these two leads. In a way, like, Elgort's casting is sort of funny to me because he's a block of wood. I mean, but then the original guy...
He really is.
The original guy wasn't that exciting either. When it does soar, it soars really beautifully. And, like, you know, the incredible overhead shot, you see a little bit of it in the trailer, don't you? But the overhead shot of the jets and the sharks kind of coming towards each other and these long shadows that they're casting on the floor. And, I mean, that's all just gorgeous.
It does feel very epic in a way that musicals kind of rarely do anymore. But I agree with you. I think Ansel Elgort was basically cast because he's very tall, and that's his defining characteristic as a character, which I thought was unintentionally hilarious in the film. But yeah, the supporting cast really worked for me. But I gotta ask you, what did you think of Rita Moreno's role in this film? And I know she's also credited as an exec producer, and obviously she was such a standout as Anita in the original that it felt like a very sweet connective tissue to the legacy of West Side Story.
It's such a nice callback. And I kind of expected her to do that typical thing where you have like a tiny cameo for someone of her age. I think she just turned 90, but she looks amazing and she's singing and she has a proper role, which is really nice. And there is one scene that's a really crucial scene in the film, which is when Anita's character, obviously originally played by Rita Moreno, comes in and is sort of attacked and sexually assaulted by a bunch of the Jets. And in that scene, it's Rita Moreno's character who then comes in and sort of says, what are you all doing? And that didn't quite land for me. I don't think it was Moreno's fault. I think the writing was a little bit clunky for me. But generally speaking, I think like she's a really wonderful addition, particularly because when you read interviews with her or read her story in real life, what she went through in Hollywood of the old days, you know, a lot of kind of sexual assault, a lot of racism that she dealt with herself. It's kind of... There's something about the resilience of her appearing in this that's like quite moving.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And kind of it does add that extra layer of pathos. And the fact that, you know, she really broke through in a big way and then was really stalled by the systemic issues of Hollywood at the time because of this role of Anita, to see her go back and that, I gotta admit, even though that scene didn't completely land, just having the two Anita's face to face really did have a little bit of an emotional gut punch for me, because I just think Ariana DeBose, who plays this new Anita, is just so forceful in the best possible way. She is giving everything to the movie, every ounce of kind of completely blank, emotionless, quote unquote, performance that Ansel is giving us. She just goes full throttle and really carries, I think, the emotional landing of the film for me.
I mean, really strong performance and really taken out of the Rita Moreno playbook, for sure.
Now, at time of recording, I haven't actually seen West Side Story yet, but I am so intrigued. The way Anna and Christina were talking about it, it has made me even more keen to watch. So that film opens at your local picture house on the 10th of December. It sounds like a big screen spectacle, if nothing else. I'll be there, day one, front row. I love a musical. It's funny, isn't it? They're often released at December. The last big one, I suppose, was The Greatest Showman. That also came out around this time. Let's see if West Side Story's got the same legs as The Greatest Showman. And now, genuinely, I say this a lot on this podcast if you're a long-time listener. Genuinely, though, really, I couldn't think of two films that sort of sat more opposite each other in terms of how different they are. Now for something completely different. The new film starring Noomi Rapace, Lamb.
Dare keep up. With the teeth.
So I have to ask you about the, talk about a left turn, but I have to ask you about Lamb. The Icelandic slow burn horror film. Well, what did you think?
It's interesting that you call it a slow burn horror, because when I went to see it, I expected a slow burn horror. And what I found was a very moving, very kind of emotional love story, and specifically a love story not just about a couple, but about a family, and a couple who really, really want and try to make a family. It just so happens that their new child is half lamb, half human, which adds an element of weirdness to the film that kind of really downplays itself. So I think that the marketing of the film really positions it as a horror film, but I actually thought it was kind of a more of a magical realist family drama. What did you make of it?
I mean, it's so much about, it's really good, like on the money what you said, really, because it's about grief, isn't it, in many ways, and motherhood, and being an animal lover, like Herc. I mean, particularly in the first segment when you don't entirely realize that it's not just a baby lamb that she's got, and she's kind of using it as a surrogate infant and walking around with it in a blanket. I was like, I could see myself doing something like this, like just being really extra with a baby lamb. It's so sweet. So yeah, as it unfolds and becomes more and more strange, I guess, and you realize that something strange is afoot, and there's all these really great quiet shots of the other animals around, the sheep in the fields outside on this farm, the dog, the cat inside, all looking like, what is this thing, and it doesn't belong in our house kind of stuff. It is unnerving, but I think you're right that actually overwhelmingly it's probably more emotionally affecting than you would expect. And I mean, honestly, I think where it falls down is in the last section where you get this big reveal. Yeah, I didn't love the ending, just because I was like, oh, you've showed me that. I don't want to say too much, but what do you think about the ending?
I quite like the ending. I'll admit that I kind of saw it coming, or I felt it coming, really, because we don't really see anything. It doesn't really plant enough seeds, but it does through, this is going to sound hyper pretentious, but you mentioned it, so I'm going to go with it, the performance of the animals. You can kind of see through the reactions of the sheep and the lambs to what is kind of, you know, the original inciting incident. You can see that there's something quite dark afoot that might come back into the picture. So I always had this sense of dread, like this happiness, this perfect, although an orthodox little family that they've got going is not going to last, which really tinted the whole experience of watching this film for me with a lot of sadness, you know, because they really embraced, and then especially when the brother character comes in, kind of fought for the permanence of this family and accepting this little child, this little lamb child, into it, and completely kind of non-judgmentally. And then, but there was always a sense of, oh no, something's going to happen. And I think the animals know. But because it never really goes into over-explaining it, into any mythology, it just gives you the feeling of it, which really works for me. I'm quite partial to these kind of magical realist / horror adjacent films that play with the supernatural without making it into a supernatural rule book, if that makes sense.
I really like the kind of atmosphere as well of the film. Like, it's just so, like you say, it's not doing anything explicit. I think there's like one slight mention of folklore, and it's just like a side, like sort of sidebar thing. It's like something they're watching on TV. But the director was very interested in like Icelandic folklore and legend. And it's not taken from anything specific, but I like the idea that it's playing with that. And you can kind of see in such a remote place with all of this fog and these kind of very majestic rolling hills and mountains, and you can, you know, feel, you can almost feel how cold it is, and there's just something about that large empty space, it's quite forbidding and quite scary, which I like.
Did it feel almost a little bit like Icelandic Gothic to you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really good shout.
I am really, really intrigued by Lamb. Again, it's one I've not been able to watch just yet, but it's had a great life on the film festival circuit. And I do think Noomi Rapace as a performer makes really interesting choices here, and she's always great to watch. I mean, she always, you know, delivers a stunning performance. So I'm really, really intrigued by this film. It's one that I don't know too much about, other than, you know, Christina and Anna's excellent review just there. And I think that's probably enough from me. I now want to go and watch the film and you know, go on this journey and be surprised myself. So that's Lamb. That's in cinemas this December. And yeah, it sounds like if you're looking for something darker than West Side Story, maybe check that one out. And now, staying in Europe, let's go to the third film on this podcast, Maria Sodal's Hope, starring Stellan Skarsgård. And at the end of Christina and Anna's review, do stick around because Anna spoke to writer and director of Hope, Maria Sodal, on Zoom earlier this week. So you'll hear Christina and Anna discussing the film, and then Anna's going to jump on Zoom, and you'll hear their interview about making the movie.
Jeg skulle ha gått fra meg for lenge siden, men jeg har vært for sliten.
There's no kind of good segue from one film to another, but I think one of the interesting points of the next film we need to talk about, Hope, is the fact that it really centers the relationship of a couple, and a couple who are kind of quite isolated from everyone else around them because of one thing or another, a lamb baby in Lamb and an incurable disease in Hope. So what did you make of Hope?
I found it really, really moving, really difficult, naturally, given the subject matter of a woman who's been diagnosed with incurable cancer and how she deals with it over the course of a holiday season. I think it's about a week. You know, how it actually, you know, things like this have a tendency to, of course, have a huge knock-on effect on families. They have quite a large sort of melded family of you know, kids of various ages. But this actually kind of brings them closer together in a situation where the marital situation is not very good to begin with. And Stellan Skarsgård is really wonderful in this part, as well as this husband who realizes slowly how, I guess, inattentive he's been for a long time, and how much they've ignored each other in certain ways for a long time. I found it really moving. The performances are great.
They were so fantastic. It's this sort of mature, adult-centered, feeling-centered drama that you get very rarely, I think, anymore. And when something like this comes along, and there's, you know, this big kind of not that uncommon situation, you know, not just dealing with cancer, but dealing with a big life-altering disease, and the idea of mortality, and suddenly shedding a lot of preconceptions or a lot of obligations that people think they have. And it's really beautiful to see how this marriage kind of doesn't implode, but it sort of reveals itself throughout the running time of the film, because they kind of react in the normal ways, and I'm kind of using air quotes here, but also they, as they progress, and it's not the usual kind of cancer movie narrative where they go through chemo, and, you know, we're kind of used to a certain type of image of these stories, a certain type of narrative. This is very different. It's much more up and down. It's, do we get a little bit of a sliver of hope? How can we talk to our friends about this? How am I going to feel? Do we still love each other? Do we still want each other? Is now the moment where we talk about all of our deepest, darkest secrets that we've never voiced to each other? It becomes a very naked relationship because of this thing, but this thing never really goes away, and it's never really fully resolved, which I think was so, so well written and so moving. And there's kind of explosive moments in the film that really worked for me, but never really go into the melodramatic.
I think it's really hard with something like this not to end up heavy-handed simply through, even while ignoring some of the major, I guess, cliches or tropes. It's really hard to, I guess, through attachment to the character, attachment to the issue, not end up there in some way, especially when you have such talented actors. But there's something about its refusal to over-explain, and its refusal to, as you say, kind of provide easy answers when we know that life does not provide those. And I think the way it sits with the characters as well, it's got like a really languid like pacing. It kind of lets things unfold in a way which feels natural, because these things develop as you're dealing with them, and as people are reacting to them. The way a 16-year-old kid reacts to it is not the same as a grown child would react.
Yeah, it felt almost, I don't know if you got the same feeling, but it felt a little bit like a play almost, or as if it were adapted from a play, in that sense where it doesn't feel like a very big movie, but it's dealing with very, with very large emotional landscapes.
I always like going back to the beginning with these questions, and I really wanted to ask you, I've read a couple of other interviews about the film, but I wanted to ask you where it became a film, where it started for you. When did you know that you wanted to make Hope?
As it is a very, very autobiographical project. It started out with me having a diagnosis of having 3 more months to live. And then 3 years afterwards, I was alive still. And so death was cancelled, and I was in grief that I couldn't do what I used to do, which was writing and making movies, etc. So I got this question if I wanted to direct a big American movie in Stockholm. And I said hello to the producer. Haven't you heard what happened to me? What's happened to me? And she said, yes, and I hear that everything is so fine. And it was not very fine at all. I was not well. So 3 years after that, again, I started working on another project, and it just didn't work. And this was in his way, so I had to deal with it, sort of. So that's how it came about, almost against my own will.
I kind of love the way you put it, kind of the project coming together against your own will. And I know it's autobiographical, but I wanted to ask you as well on that note, kind of how did you find keeping the balance before the personal story, your story, and, whether the story that you were making in the film demanded something different, the narrative demanded something different. How did you balance those two?
It's weird. But the real story has this wonderful structure. You know, it's so close to what actually happened as for being, happening in those Christmas week, etc. And I tried for a long time to, you know, let them have 2 kids instead of 6, and not having it to be, spread of lung cancer to, you know, head metastasis, and making all these things. And I just realized, after 6 months or so, that if you're going to do something which is autobiographical, you can't do a little bit this and a little bit fiction. You have to go all the way, because anything which has really happened has an inner logic. And if you try to mix those, it becomes a hybrid, and the inner logic, which is the beauty of, you know, such a story, disappears. So it's about having that it's enough time passing before you deal with it, and you work with memories. And when you work with memories, everything becomes crystallized. The emotions becomes crystallized, and the sort of the noise disappears. And that's when you can put together a story, which is fiction in a way, because you deal with the universal stuff, which emotions are universal. And that's not me, it's us in a way. So I think that was something I, you know, which I didn't, it was not an intellectual exercise. I just, you know, something you came to through the process.
And kind of picking up on memories, did you find that when you were going, shifting through memories and trying to crystallize them, as you say, was it more important to get to the core emotion of the memory rather than the detail and the accuracy of what really happened and portraying that on screen?
I think I was going for what was shamefully truth. because that was the only thing that excited me and while writing it, you know, to find those situations which had that emotion, which was so disturbing that I almost didn't dare to remember them, you know, trying to survive and knowing that there is no hope for survival, you become totally navel-gazing. And then you do stuff which is, hopelessly shameful.
But it's true, sometimes kind of in those, acknowledging those shameful emotions is where the real kind of emotional truth lies, I think, sometimes.
Yes, I think so. And I think, you know, also I realized after having made the movie that one of the most, you know, that the audience reacts upon is the taboo of the modern family, of how you love your biological kids in a different way than your stepchildren. It's not less or more, it's different. Sometimes it's less, you know, either way, but still it's something that we don't talk about. And that is also something which was, you know, going through those things which people don't talk too much about.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about how you worked with your actors on this film, and specifically because their performances feel so natural and so raw and uninhibited. How did you work with them? Did you have much time to rehearse? Was it strange to direct essentially a version of your memories and your experience for you?
Key was that I was not making a movie about myself. That at this stage, I was writing a movie about myself. But when the script was there and I felt that this was a fictionalized, it was a story and which I could deal with myself, I only wanted them to create something I didn't know, something I hadn't, to interpret it in their way and give me presents, gifts, which I didn't, you know, I didn't know was there. So we talked a lot for 3 weeks and got to know each other very, very well so that they could dare to do stuff. And I was giving a lot away, more than was in the script. So I think it was about daring to go places and making a set which was very intimate and very comfortable and safe. And we laughed and laughed and laughed and laughed and had fun because we were very much into finding the non-sentimental drive in the story, because there was no time for grief in the story. In real life and in the fiction, there was no time for that. So we wanted to make a movie where, as you know, you didn't have to make sure that the audience would pick, you know, would understand everything, because you just had to follow it was happening. And she, as she is on steroids, she's also quite high and strong.
And actually, on that note, one of the things I think kind of really plays into that intention is the way that you use the camera. I found it very unobtrusive, but at the same time, almost, you know, moving around and following wherever the action was. And the action sometimes could just be a look on a character's faces. Can you talk a little bit about how you wanted to approach this story visually, considering that what you just said about kind of there being no time for grief while they're actually in the middle of this?
Manuel, who's the DP, Manuel Claro, he did my first movie called Limbo, shooting in Trinidad and Tobago, and where there was like no infrastructure, etc. But he is a wonderful handheld DP, really. So that was our training for this movie, which came, you know, with my, you know, many, many years away, hiatus. It's both him and, of course, the fact that we were going to tell about life, and life is very much in all that. It's a huge family and lots of people, so faces were very important, and all the emotions which is in the in their faces, because they're tiptoeing around this crazy character of this woman who's going to die. And who's very direct and raw. As we didn't do any rehearsals, we started shooting while rehearsing on set. So he became a part of the scene. He became one of the characters almost. So the actors, they almost didn't notice that he was there. And we were shooting 3 weeks in the apartment, which was a wonderful, wonderful studio set, where there was no lighting in the rooms, it was on the outside. So there was no technical equipment, which was inhibiting.
And Maria, I realize our time is running out, but I just wanted to ask you a final question. And what would you like people to take away from this film?
I'm no missionary. I think people, you know, should think about their lives and decisions they make, choices they do, and just realize that it's now. And
thank you so much, Maria. I really appreciate the time.
Thank you as well.
Oh, thank you so much, Maria, for joining us, and for Anna for doing the interview, for hopping on Zoom with Maria earlier this week. This is a fascinating film, obviously very personal to Maria, as you heard there. I love Stellan Skarsgård. I think he's an incredible actor, and I love how versatile he is, from Mamma Mia to Marvel Avengers to Pirates of the Caribbean to Lars von Trier. You know, like his choices are so interesting. And I mean, we saw him earlier this year, or a lot of people did anyway, in Dune. I thought he was remarkable in Dune as one of the villains. Lots of prosthetics and makeup and stuff to play that role. And in Hope, he is... it's none of that. This is a realistic film. But in Hope, you just see him doing some incredible acting. He's one of the greatest actors of his generation. And it's always a treat to see him. And he's often in an ensemble, so you don't get to see him in like a starring role. But I think he's wonderful in Hope. And I do highly recommend checking Hope out when it comes to your local picture house cinema on the 10th of December. Here we go into the final film of this podcast. We are going to talk about the Palme d'Or, the top prize at the Cannes Film Festival, winning film Titane, from writer-director Julia Ducournau, who a couple of years ago, maybe 2017, 2018, her debut feature film, Raw, was released in cinemas, and we definitely played that one at Picture House. A remarkable film, one of my favourites that year. So I've been eagerly anticipating what she's going to do next, and blimey, what she's done next is remarkable. It's a very surprising, hugely cinematic piece called Titane. I can't wait to hear what Christina and Anna make of this film. Here we go.
And we've only really got one more movie to talk about, and it's probably the most difficult one to talk about. Let's just go with its accolades first, because that's the only way to introduce it. This is the Palme d'Or winning film from Julia Ducournau, who is the director of Raw, which came out a few years ago. And this movie, to say that this movie has been hyped up is probably even an understatement. I'm bursting to talk about it, but what did you think about it, Christina? I'm so curious.
I have a lot of mixed feelings about Titane. I've seen it twice now, once on the big screen, and I am so impressed by the parts of it that I like, and so underwhelmed by the parts of it that I, you know, all of the things that I watched the first time and was like, that's so smart, and I love this so much about it. I still love, and I almost feel like quite deeply divided in myself about it, which makes it even harder to talk about. But I think the stuff that it does with gender, the stuff that it's doing about identification, the stuff that it does about the performance of masculinity, the Vincent Lindon character as this father who's, you know, his son has gone missing, and now the main character, Alexia, is disguising herself because she's a serial killer on the run, and disguised herself as his lost child. And that relationship of like, when does he become aware that maybe that's actually not his kid, but he doesn't really, he's still invested. And the amount of tenderness and love that he shows her regardless. All of that relationship stuff in the middle is the stuff that really kept me glued to it, and that I found a lot of intelligence and tenderness in.
What about the things that didn't work for you so much?
I think the first 20 minutes.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's very stylish, it's very cool, but to me, it just feels like straight out of like the Gaspar Noé playbook of like, let's see how uncomfortable we can get the audience. Will they walk out in the first 20 minutes? And then actually it settles down into kind of the story that it actually is. So it sort of shapeshifts, and that's interesting. But I think maybe the most interesting thing, if I'm going to, you know, give it its credit, is making Alexia a serial killer and then having her sort of change gender, so to speak, is making it so that she has a terrible secret. But the terrible secret that we feel she has is not the one that is as it's presented, I suppose, in the story. Of course, it's not a terrible secret, but it's sort of creating this almost false narrative of horror at transness or something, which I think is a really interesting way to kind of poke at people's preconceptions and their biases. So I think that's really interesting. However, I also kind of thought the first 20 minutes just felt narratively like, is this necessary? Like, why, like, do I need to see her try and give herself an abortion with a hairpin? Not really. That didn't seem necessary to me. Sorry. So
interesting. I think there's something that you said that I completely agree with you. And I can also see why this is the element that will divide people about this film. It's the shape-shifting aspect of it. And I purposefully kind of ignored all reviews, all trailers. I wanted to go in as blind as possible into this film. And I had no idea where it was going. It kept changing paces. It kept changing narratives. And only at the end of it did it kind of all sort of fit in together in a way that perhaps narratively doesn't, but it does for the character. And I think it's Alexia's transformation that really is the guiding light through the whole of Titan. But actually, I don't think the final part works without the first part. I actually really, really liked the first 20 minutes because they did set you up to be in a completely different film. Although I felt it really, it did not lean into the kind of the extremity of, or the visual extremity of filmmakers like Gaspar Noé as much as I initially thought it might be. I thought it was going that direction and then it really pulled back and went and swerved completely into something else. I felt like it was very, very cold and that coldness was necessary. Because that's Alexia's worldview. That's the way that she interacts with the world. She's basically dead inside. She's terribly cold and unfeeling. So the bursts of violence and the bursts of color and movement that exist there really worked for me because it just kind of kept lifting up the fact that she doesn't really feel the world like other people do. So once she actually starts interacting with Vincent Landon's character, that's when she kind of starts coming alive a little bit. And that transformation is beautiful to behold. So the fact that kind of that film...
Yeah, once we get the warmth.
Yeah. And it's, you know, not to get all Game of Thrones in it, but it is kind of starts kind of with the icy aspects of her personality and her coldness and the coldness of her violence. And ends with this incredibly warm environment that she repels at the beginning, but ends up understanding. And that for a film that's being billed as kind of a body horror film and kind of, you know, having all of this hype around it of it being extreme and very terrifying, it is. And I think at the heart of it, it's a person learning how to love.
That's very beautiful.
The fact that you like brought up the attempted abortion with a hairpin, I was like, it's about a girl learning how to love someone. It's really sweet.
I like this. This is good. Well, you know, balances each other out well.
It's a film of extremes. Let's just say it's a film of extremes.
It truly is.
But I'm curious, kind of, how did you find watching it in the cinema versus, I'm assuming you watched it a second time on a link. Kind of, how do you think it works for you as an experience? Because that's the thing that really got under my skin so much, because I found it so much a full-bodied cinematic experience.
Oh God, yeah. Yeah, the sound as well. Saw it at the premiere at LFF, mm-hmm. and it was just like, I found it quite intense. I was also hungover, and I for the first 20 minutes, I was just like, you know what I mean? When something's just really like
once that like nipple piercing scene
in
happens,
a way that feels
no, that's not good. Not a good combo for a hangover.
And I think I would consider myself pretty good with screen violence. And I just, yeah, for the first 20 minutes, I did struggle. So the second time I found it a little easier just because I guess I was like, brace. But there's one scene that I really love, kind of about gender and identity and expectations around those things, which is when Alexia goes to leave and kind of leave Vincent Lyndon's house and she gets on a bus. And there's a girl across from her who is quite nastily being sexually threatened and abused by some guys on the back of the bus. And the girl looking at her as though, looking at her like a man, almost as if to say, aren't you going to say something to them? And her feeling these simultaneous pressures and terrors gets off the bus and avoids that confrontation. To me, of all the big moments everyone talks about in the film, that to me is one of the best scenes in the film. So yeah, I think it's one of those films that even though I don't feel great about it all the time or all the way through, I think everyone should see it because it's so thought-provoking. It's so unlike anything else.
So there we go. That's the four new films coming to your local picture house cinemas this month. Thank you to Anna and Christina for reviewing those films for us. Now, as is customary on this podcast, whilst we've got two excellent film critics on mic talking about movies, we'd like to ask them what's currently on in cinemas that they might recommend, and also what they're looking forward to watching in the future. So let's hear that now.
So Anna, is there anything out at the minute that you would recommend that I go see at cinema?
I mean, I'm pretty confident you've seen it already, Christina, but I mean, I know you've seen it, but I cannot get enough of House of Gucci. I just think it's so fun. It is so bloated, but it is so excessive and so tacky. A lot of people have called it camp, but I actually think tacky is the better way to describe it. And honestly, I will just give any amount of money to watch Lady Gaga do anything on the big screen. She really lifts that movie up from something a bit meh to something hugely enjoyable and entertaining. And even though it's quite long, it's over 2.5 hours long, it really flew by for me because of just how watchable she is and how much she's giving to the role. And also it's fashion and it's murder. It's all great things. What about you?
Hard agree. Also, I think Adam Driver's actually quite good in it. I mean, I'm not sure he's in the same film as Lady Gaga, but I do like him in it. Though it could be purely because he's so fabulously well-dressed in every scene. It is a feast for the senses, in my opinion.
Yeah, he can really pull off a suit, can't he?
I also feel like Lady Gaga is, I mean, she is the Barbra Streisand of her generation. She has got everything about, like, she is that talented musical performer that's also, you know, gets on the screen and just, you can't take your eyes off of her. And sometimes she chooses scenery or kind of acts other people off the screen a bit, but you're kind of just here for it the whole time because
she's a movie star.
She's like a force of nature.
Yeah, I think she's kind of an almost like an old type of movie star that we're not really getting anymore that much.
Yeah, all of her appearances are exciting. Even with her ridiculous method acting.
And what about you? Is there anything that's already showing in cinemas in the UK that you're excited about?
So there is a little film called Petite Maman by Celine Sciamma, the director of Portrait of a Lady on Fire. And it's just such a lovely little film. It's like, what, 75 minutes long, I think, or something like that. It's so adorably small, and it's pitched on such a small level. It's just about a little girl whose grandmother has just passed away, and her mother and her father go to her mother's childhood home to clean out the house. And then one day, you know, in the midst of the kind of grief, the grieving process, her mother decides it's a bit too much, and she decides to leave and let the little girl and her dad finish off. And when her mother kind of exits stage left, enters a girl who's an exact doppelganger for this little girl, and they start to become really good friends. And it becomes increasingly clear that there are some weird parallels where this other little girl is basically her mother when her mother was say 8 years old, the same age. They're played by twins in real life. And, you know, it's this wonderful story of, like, the house is sort of this cottage in the woods, and they play outside in that kind of old school way of, like, there's no Nintendo Switch, there's no phones, there are kids playing outside and building little tree houses and huts and kind of adventuring together. And it's such a wonderful film that doesn't seek to over-explain what kind of bond this is or who that child is per se. You know, she does say at one point, the little girl's like, you know, it's my mother. But you're kind of left to think about, is this some sort of reflection of her mother's childhood? Or is it, you know, is it a fantasy? Is it a dream? And it lets you kind of think on what it means for a mother and a daughter, no matter how close they are, to really understand and know each other and to really be able to get close to one another by seeing each other in a completely different way. I just think it's a very beautiful film.
That's such a beautiful description of it, and such opposite films as well. A very bloated, fashion-y murder mystery, a crime drama that's over 2.5 hours long, and a beautiful, nuanced family portrait by Celine Sciamma.
I would be remiss if I didn't say I was looking forward to Paul Thomas Anderson's Licorice Pizza, which is out in the new year, I think. It's out New Year's Day. And it, by all accounts, is sort of a quite loosely narrative film about a 15-year-old boy in love with an older girl set in the 70s in Southern California. To me, it looks a lot like Inherent Vice, which I also absolutely love from Paul Thomas Anderson. And I mean, what is there to say except for that? He's a modern master, one of the greatest living American filmmakers, and it's set in the 70s, and I have such a soft spot for that. So,
I mean, Christina, you had me at PTA. Like, I don't really need any more information. And also, yeah, I cannot wait to see that film. And same as with other films that I'm really excited about, I've kind of avoided as much as possible about it just so I can fully luxuriate in the Paul Thomas Anderson 70s experience again. I love that he's going back to that decade. I also really, really enjoyed Inherent Vice, even though it got a kind of a mixed reception. I think that film just gets better and better the more times you watch it. And I'm most excited about a small indie British film that's going to be coming out in late December called Boiling Point. And it's all a one-shot film. It's all a frenetic day in the life of a chef in a London restaurant. It was actually filmed very close to where I live in a real-life operating restaurant. It's just him trying to juggle his life, his marriage, his kids, his business, his staff, the dishes of the day, all the manias and the dramas that happen in a high-pressured environment, a kitchen being one of them. So it's completely insane. It's non-stop. All of the characters, though, feel very fleshed out, just popping in occasionally onto the screen. The tensions that are very specific to a restaurant or a kitchen feel so natural and coming from such an organic place. And I've seen it described as kind of the uncut gems of the kitchen, and I think it's absolutely on point. It's one of these films that becomes increasingly stressful to watch, and by the end of it, you're so relieved it's over, but it feels like such an experience and a film that really, really grabs you and doesn't let you go until it's done, until it's ready to release you. And I really recommend it.
Here for Stephen Graham, always.
Always. So Christina, if people want to find out more about the work that you do, where can people find you online? What have you got coming up?
You can find me on Twitter more often than I should be, at Christina LeFou. And you can find my newsletter, which is about women in crime films, on Substack. It's called Sisters Under the Mink. And the next edition is going to be about Gaga in House of Gucci.
Amazing. I can't wait to read that edition. I can be found on Twitter as well, tweeting a lot less than I should, at Anna B. Demented. And I also host the Final Ghost podcast, which is currently focusing on teen horror. And we're just about to enter the 90s, which is my favorite horror period. And also on the weekly American Horror Story Recap podcast, The Next Supremes, which I co-host with my friend Clarice Lockery. And everything that I do, I try to remember to post it over on my Twitter.
And that brings us to the end of another episode of The Love of Cinema. Thank you so much for listening to our December edition of the show. It's been a hard year for everybody. It's been quite an uncertain year for cinema in terms of, you know, would we be allowed to reopen? Would films get cinema releases? Would they go to streaming? You know, a few films have moved to 2022. Looking at you, Top Gun Maverick, but a lot of films have come out this year, and it's been a really, you know, as you heard there from Christina and Anna, there's some incredible films out now and films that have come out previously. So thank you for coming to the movies and for listening to the show. Couldn't do this without you. Wouldn't do this without you. Huge thank you, of course, to Christina Newland and Anna Bogoskaya for being our guest film critics in December. I'm a huge fan of their work, and yeah, I've popped some links to sort of further reading additional material in the show notes. Do check that out and give them a follow on social media. Big thank you to Kobe and the gang at Stripped Media for producing the show, and of course to our wonderful editor, Maddie Searle, for pulling it all together. Thank you, Maddie. You make us all sound great. If you'd like to hear more about what's on at your local Picturehouse Cinema, please go to picturehouses.com and check it out. And if you want to follow Picturehouse Cinemas to see the latest film news, you can do so at Picturehouses on Twitter and Instagram, and by searching Picturehouses on Facebook. If you're a fan of Christmas movies, do check the listings for your local Pitch House cinema, because there's some great stuff on, as well as the new releases we talked about. We've got a fantastic Christmas season, It's a Wonderful Life, Home Alone, The Muppets Christmas Carol, you know the score by now, but they're all back at the movies, and it's fun to watch them on the big screen with an audience. Well, that's just about it from me. Thank you so much for listening. I said it, stop. Please do rate, review and subscribe if you can on your podcatcher app of choice. We'll be back for a couple of special interviews with filmmakers on this feed later in the month. So again, another reason to subscribe. You can stay up to date with all the latest interviews we might do. And we'll be doing our end of the year roundup with a few of my colleagues from Picture House. I'm looking forward to recording that and seeing what everybody's highlights and lowlights of the film release calendar were. That will be coming out closer to Christmas. Thank you so much for listening. Hope to see you at the cinema soon. And stay safe, stay well. We'll be back for another podcast in the not too distant future.